try to put 100 people in Barrow, Alaska. And after the first 50 show up, the other 50 will be fending off polar bears.
The Coast Guard outlines challenges in the Chukchi Sea. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a dramatic rise in heroin overdose deaths in Alaska.
It's one of those things that tends not to get in the news very often because it doesn't happen all at once.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Alaska Pacific University is a private liberal arts and sciences university that emphasizes student engagement with the social, cultural, and environmental issues in Alaska and the world. This message sponsored by APU.
As Shell gears up to drill in the Chukchi Sea this summer, the Coast Guard is getting ready too. At an Arctic symposium in Washington, D.C. this morning, the head of the U.S. Coast Guard outlined the difficulties the service will face in the Chukchi Sea this summer and in the Arctic generally. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Coast Guard Commandant Paul Zukunft says if Shell is allowed to drill in the Chukchi Sea this summer, the Coast Guard will be there with 5 ships and 2 aircraft. But the Admiral says nothing about the Arctic is easy.
We are a service that prides itself on being semper paratus, always ready. But this area really does present a challenge for us.
Policing Shell is a big part of the job. Zunkoft says the Coast Guard will be there to ensure the company follows the rules.
As they exploit these riches, there is zero room for failure. And by that, I mean an oil spill in the Arctic.
Zunkoft says environmental activists may pose one complication.
We may have a run-in with NGOs if Shell gets its final permit. Greenpeace did protest when Russia was drilling in their Arctic domain. They were imprisoned for about 16 months. I don't think we'll take as harsh measures in the United States, but we need to be there as an enforcement arm.
The worst-case scenario is a well blowout. Zunkoff says the lack of onshore facilities would hamper the response. Zunkoft was the federal on-scene coordinator for the Deepwater Horizon spill 5 years ago.
We had 47,000 responders that were marshaled to the Gulf of Mexico, and you can't do that anywhere else but in the Gulf of Mexico. Try to put 100 people in Barrow, Alaska, and after the first 50 show up, the other 50 will be fending off polar bears. We do not have the infrastructure.
That, he says, is why Shell is moving nearly 30 ships to the Arctic for the short drilling season and why the company is required to have a relief rig and a well capping stack on hand. The ship carrying that capping stack got a lesson in the hazards of the Arctic just outside Dutch Harbor July 3 when its hull was cracked. Presumably, the Finnish-owned icebreaker Fennica hit an uncharted object. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration was surveying nearby and was able to check out the area. NOAA found areas that were shallower than charted, but Senior Arctic Advisor Dave Kennedy says it's not clear what the Fennica hit.
They're still analyzing the data, but the preliminary report is that there is nothing obvious that they could find that would indicate something that looked like it should have been an obstacle there.
A Shell spokesman says the Fennica will be patched up in Dutch Harbor, then sent to Oregon for permanent repair. Shell says the mishap won't delay the Chukchi Sea operation because the capping stack isn't needed until August. Admiral Robert Papp, a former head of the Coast Guard, says the Fennica may have hit something like an underwater spire, a natural structure he says would be hard for surveyors to spot. Papp is now the State Department's Special Arctic Representative, and at the Arctic Symposium, he hinted at a big, high-level meeting in Alaska next month.
I can't talk a lot about that today, but it will draw the attention of the world to Alaska and the Arctic, and I'm very excited about it.
Months ago, Senator Lisa Murkowski let slip that President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry plan to visit Alaska in August. The exact date and which communities they'll visit aren't publicly known. Papp says he expects an announcement shortly. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A recent NOAA study found that by 2040, Alaskan shellfish hatcheries may no longer be sustainable because of ocean acidification unless serious mitigation efforts are put in place. Yesterday, we reported on a hatchery in Oregon that's become a model for adapting to these different conditions. But the long-term solution may actually lie in shellfish genes. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
Evolution and resiliency are the buzzwords for a sustainable mariculture industry in Alaska, a state that is particularly vulnerable.
And Alaska is going to be the test bed, unfortunately, for informing us for how the rest of the ecosystem will respond to ocean acidification.
Jeremy Mathis is a NOAA oceanographer who worked on the recent study based at the Aleutic Pride Shellfish Hatchery in Seward. He says one short-term solution hatcheries are testing is injecting the acidic ocean water in their tanks with carbonates that are needed for organisms like clams and mussels to develop hard shells. But in the long term, Mathis says they may need to turn to genetics for answers.
Ideally, we could start looking at species that are more resilient to ocean acidification and adapting the commercial fisheries and the commercial processing to animals that have that robustness to tolerate ocean acidification as opposed to the ones that are more vulnerable to it.
That's where scientists like Gretchen Hoffman come in. She's a marine biology professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
I work on reinvertebrates and sometimes fish, and we study how they respond to their environment. We would call it environment-organism interactions. And lately, we've been interested in how these organisms will respond to future changes in ocean pH and ocean warming.
She's a leader in what Mathis calls the emerging field of genetic adaptability.
So it really just started with a conversation with oceanographers who are thinking about this. And from there, we started to do experiments, and then we started to ask deeper questions about whether or not organisms could adapt to these changes in the ocean, and even if there are already genotypes and strains of organisms that are already able to handle a low pH condition.
She says the first experiments they did were a bit too basic for Mother Nature. They'd take species, put them in water with different pHs, and see how they'd react. And that didn't reflect natural variations in ocean conditions.
What we found was that there wasn't just this, like, you know, straight line, no pH change, but that pH was going up and down, sometimes quite dramatically.
Alaskan waters, for example, are very cold and have shifting pHs depending on the seasons, fresh water inputs, and how much CO2-rich glacial melt is present. From Washington to California, the coast is subject to a phenomenon known as upwelling, which is a cycle of seasonal winds pushing newer, oxygen-rich water off the surface of the ocean and older, nutrient- and CO2-rich water rising up to take its place, and that means a lot of pH fluctuation. So Hoffman says they shifted their sea urchin research to take upwelling into account.
And we formed the hypothesis to test that the adults from the place where there was a lot of low pH exposure would be genetically different from the wimpy ones that did not experience all that low pH stress.
They found that the urchins from areas with upwelling had a different genetic signature from those who weren't, and their progeny, or babies, were more tolerant of acidic water.
It was even more interesting because it looks like the trait of being able to tolerate that low pH, that was heritable.
She points to work being done in New Zealand, where different types of green-shelled mussels are being crossbred to develop a new resistant and adaptive strain. So an Alaskan hatchery, for example, could choose to make the shift from some common species being raised now to ones that selectively favor that trait. But it also may mean letting go of consumer preference for certain types of clams, mussels, and other shellfish that just don't measure up.
These are things that we should be taking a strong look at because it could be that there are other strains of shellfish that could be used that would be more successful in a mariculture setting. But it is a very thorny issue and one that I think science can bring a lot of daylight to if we work together on it.
Hoffman says it's important for industry and scientists to start partnering now to get ahead of the game as much as possible. But Mathis says
the first thing we have to do, though, is get carbon dioxide emission levels under control. And then we can deal with the damage that has already been done through mitigation and adaptation strategies.
Because the problem will only get worse with each coming year. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Juneau works to increase access to childcare.
And there's all these families. They need this, and they don't need this years from now. They need it years ago.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at FNBAlaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
A new report from the State Health Department shows a dramatic rise in heroin use in Alaska. The number of hospitalizations for heroin-related causes nearly doubled in the state from 2008 to 2012. And in 2013, 23 people in Alaska died from heroin overdose, four times the number of overdose deaths in 2008. Dr. Jay Butler is the state's chief medical officer.
When we look at the magnitude of heroin deaths combined with the magnitude of deaths due to prescription opioids, we're looking at a similar number to what we see with motor vehicle accidents. That is a problem, but it's one of those things that tends not to get in the news very often because it doesn't happen all at once.
According to the report, many addicts switch from prescription painkillers to heroin because it's cheaper and easier to find. Dr. Butler says he had a patient last year who told him he spent more on cigarettes than heroin. Butler is working to improve access to the drug naloxone, which can prevent overdose deaths, and he wants to make the state's prescription drug monitoring program more user-friendly for prescribers and pharmacists and more well-known.
We also need to get the word out. I'll be honest, I'm a licensed physician with a DEA number. I didn't even realize we had a prescription drug monitoring program until I started working for the state.
The state's prescription drug monitoring program was established in 2008 to combat the misuse of controlled substances. Several briefs were filed last week with the Alaska Supreme Court in the Ketchikan Gateway Borough's ongoing lawsuit challenging the state of Alaska's requirement that local governments earmark a certain amount of property taxes for public education. KRBD's Layla Carey reports.
I'll go out on a limb and say I'm absolutely confident that we are correct in this matter.
Borough manager Dan Bockhorst knows the borough has a good case. They won the first round, after all, when Superior Court Judge William Carey ruled in January that the state's required local contribution for schools violates the Alaska Constitution. The question is, will the Alaska Supreme Court uphold Carey's decision? State attorneys didn't waste any time filing an appeal with the High Court, and Carey's decision was put on hold pending that appeal. Borough officials also filed an appeal because while winning the main point, they didn't get everything they wanted. Judge Carey ruled against the borough's request for a refund of the previous year's required local contribution, about $4 million. The most recent filings with the High Court allowed each side to argue why the justices should rule against the other side. The borough relied on a prior case, State versus Alex, which in the 1980s challenged a required tax which went directly from commercial fishermen to regional aquaculture associations. In that case, the Supreme Court ruled that the tax violates the Constitution's prohibition against dedicated funds. The borough's brief focuses on similarities between Alex and the current case.
It absolutely hits it every point.
One of the linchpins of the arguments that the state makes is that if the money doesn't hit the state treasury, then there can be no dedication, and you don't have to appropriate the money and all of this. But in the Alex case, the money never hit the state treasury.
That was Scott Brandt Erickson, Ketchikan's borough attorney. He explains that the Constitution stipulates that public funds can't be dedicated or earmarked by the state. Revenue has to be appropriated on an annual basis by the legislature. The state counters that the required local contribution isn't state revenue and that the statute only requires local funding, not necessarily a local tax. But Bockhorst says the only realistic way a local government can raise the mandated millions of dollars every year is through taxes, and that those local taxes are a backdoor way for the state to fund schools.
The state is able to fulfill its constitutional obligation to adequately fund schools by forcing us to levy what amounts to state taxes. And we get the blame and they get the benefit.
The borough didn't win the refund issue because Judge Carey ruled the state wasn't enriched by the required local contribution. The legislature can choose to reduce or increase school funding each year, and the mandatory local contribution doesn't necessarily factor into that process. The borough, though, contends that the state is enriched.
If we're compelled by the legislature to spend a chunk of money in furtherance of their responsibility, then that money is being spent for their benefit, whether they're required to fully fund or not.
With this latest set of briefs filed with the Alaska Supreme Court, each side now has until July 28 to respond in writing. After that, the next important date is September 16. That's when oral arguments are scheduled with the Supreme Court in Anchorage.
And the Supreme Court has signaled in the past that they plan to rule promptly, I think is the word that they used.
An exact timeline for a decision is not known, but ideally a ruling would be announced prior to the next legislative session. That way everyone would know before lawmakers convene in Juneau whether or not the state needs a whole new education funding system. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
In a letter to State Department of Transportation Commissioner Mark Lukin, State Office of Management and Budget Director Pat Pitney has advised DOT to proceed within existing appropriations to continue work on the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The memo, dated July 6th, advises DOT to seek federal loan money to pursue right-of-way requirements. The memo essentially removes the Kinnick Arm project from a state halt on mega projects. DOT spokeswoman Shannon McCarthy says the memo will allow DOT to pursue a letter of interest for a federal TIFIA loan.
We're picking up really exactly where we left off when the administrative order was issued. So we were about to pursue the letter of interest for TIFIA. We were, you know, working with the National Marine Fisheries Service for the permit, which most of the other permits hinge on this permit. And then, of course, finishing up the right-of-way, in particular working with the Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson.
McCarthy says the steps outlined in the memo are all outside of the control of the state, so it makes sense to pursue them so the state can decide whether to move forward on the bridge project or not.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Marine Conservation Council reminds Alaskans to choose local, sustainably caught seafood this summer. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
The burnt-out Gastineau apartments in Juneau will finally be demolished by the end of November, according to Juneau's city attorney. In the meantime, the city says the downtown buildings are a public safety concern. It's temporarily closed the neighboring park due to falling debris. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
The city closed Pocket Park at the end of last week. Colby Scheibler is park maintenance supervisor for Parks and Recreation.
One of our workers was in there the other day and noticed some broken glass in the fountain area and realized it wasn't a broken bottle, and then looked up and noticed a bunch of the windows were broken out in the building and realized that that glass was probably falling out of the window or had been broken out from the inside, it looked like, and was concerned about glass falling on people in the park.
Dave Lane admits people have trespassed into the apartments in the past, but now he says the buildings are more secure. Lane does construction for Gastineau apartment owners James and Kathleen Barrett.
We, as of late, and that being like the past 8 months, 9 months, have been patrolling more. Almost every evening, we come through and we make sure there's nobody in here at that time. We made sure everything's secure to the best of our abilities.
City building official Charlie Ford says the Barretts are being negligent with security.
I had been working with Mr. Barrett to try and keep the building secured, and all of a sudden, I noticed that the side door was open and there was a ladder leaning up against the runway side of the building that was obviously used for access to get into the upper floors.
Ford sent a letter to the Barretts Monday, asking them to board up more windows and clean up the remaining glass shards. He says if they don't take care of it, the city will. The apartments have been uninhabitable since a November 2012 fire. The city declared the buildings a public nuisance soon after. The Barretts have repeatedly missed deadlines for repairs or demolition. Part of the building caught on fire again in March. The Barretts had until June 19th to turn in paperwork and plans for demolishing the buildings. When they failed to do that, the city sent a letter a week later stating it would demolish them on its own. At the end of June, the assembly appropriated $1.8 million to do that. James Barrett says that's hindered his own plans to sell or demolish the buildings. He says he's talked to more than 30 companies.
It's just put me at a standstill. When we thought we were moving forward, I'm going to see where the other contractors who are bidding are going to end up. I mean, that's about all I can do at this point.
Barrett says he's considering suing the city. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
The Juneau Assembly is working on amending child care permit regulations in an effort to increase child care availability in Juneau. KTOO's Lakedra Chavis has more.
Juneau has a child care crisis. Last night, the city's Lands and Resources Committee forwarded an amendment that would change part of the land use code, allowing at-home child care facilities to watch over 12 children instead of 8. The Association for the Education of Young Children, or AUIC, provides resources and advocates quality child care in the Southeast. Coordinator Nikki Love says the organization is in full support of the amendment.
There's enough licensed care for 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 children. So this is under the age of 5. So the need is really high.
Love says that in the past few years, wait lists have increased but remain at a steady rate.
We'd like to see a decrease in barriers to child care facilities and businesses in town since there is such a great need for child care. And changing the zoning would help open the door to potential businesses.
If passed, the amendment would not affect any child care facilities currently operating. The amendment is a part of a larger comprehensive plan to fix the child care crisis in Juneau. Gold Creek Child Development Director Gretchen Boone says she's in favor of the permitting. The more child care, the better. Boone says the wait list at Gold Creek has 75 children on it, the highest she's seen despite working at the facility for nearly 2 decades.
Having more child cares out there would benefit the entire community. There are families on our waiting list who have been on our waiting list for over a year and will probably never obtain space with us.
Lisa White, former owner of Little Bear Daycare, says she also had long wait lists.
Usually by the time I would get back to some names, they were, you know, had long since found another place, but sometimes it would be a year or two.
White cites overregulation as the reason she closed her child care center in 2007. Nearly finished with the relicensing process, she called it quits as a child care provider in Juneau after 17 years, a profession that she cherished. While speaking about the lack of child care in Juneau, White got emotional. She looks forward to the situation improving for Juneau's families.
It's just going to keep getting worse unless they do something about it. And there's all these families. They need this, and they don't need this years from now. They need it. years ago.
The amendment was forwarded on to the full assembly and will be considered at a future meeting. In Juneau, I'm Lakeisha Chavis.
In 1967, Larry Davis snow machined from Nome to Cape Espenberg. When he returned, he brought with him 200 reindeer, a herd that would eventually swell to 10,000 in the 1990s. But as KNOM's Laura Craigle reports, that's just a piece of recent history.
Larry's son, Bruce Davis, is the owner of the Midnight Sun Reindeer Ranch. Yesterday, he sat down with members of the Reindeer Club to talk about the big picture.
What year do you think reindeer herding came to Alaska?
1969? 1920?
Those are the kids who make up Reindeer Club, a program born from collaboration between Davis's ranch and Nome Eskimo community. Now in its second summer, the club meets on Mondays to learn about different aspects of reindeer herding. Yesterday, Davis focused on history, explaining how reindeer were introduced to Alaska in 1892. But he didn't stop there. He touched on topics from corral construction to vaccinations to the lichens his reindeer like to eat. His goal is to educate young people on the ins and outs of reindeer herding. He says it'll take time for Alaska, having herded for just over 100 years, to catch up to places like Chukotka, Norway, Finland, and Sweden, which have been refining their techniques for 4,000 years.
We're trying to revitalize the reindeer industry again, but it's dying out, so we have to get the young people involved again. So it takes a while, and this is part of our outreach, is to let you guys know reindeer herders are still here.
For the Midnight Sun Reindeer Ranch, here means 13 miles out on the Cougarock Road. The ranch opened in 2010, and its herd now includes 100 reindeer. The most beloved is Brownie, a yearling who was orphaned before being adopted and domesticated by the Davis family. While the kids in Reindeer Club called Brownie back to her trailer on the ranch, the rest of the herd ranges across an area 50 miles wide and 30 miles deep. Davis says he eventually hopes to grow the herd to 3,000 or 4,000 reindeer, a process that could take 10 to 15 years. He also has plans to evolve the small summertime club into a larger 4-H program. For now, the Reindeer Club will meet weekly on Mondays through August. Interested kids can contact Nome Eskimo Community for more information. Reporting in Nome, I'm Laura Craigle.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Lisa Fu and Lakeisha Chavis in Juneau, and Laura Craigle in Nome. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.